The next case is 96-1114, Richard Whitehurst versus Perry Township.
Suggested then that you take some action. Wasn't it already then too late?
Sure. Absolutely.
So why would they notify you to take action?
I don't think that they thought it was too late.
But, I mean, that's an important point.
I think it is just a very important point.
Because by April 9th or 10th, or May 9th or 10th, the statute, if it's applied this way, would have run.
Absolutely.
Now, you received a letter from the department then?
I received a letter from the
Attorney General saying that the appeal had been filed and that you should file a complaint.
Right. But I say filed.
Okay. And then you filed it by June?
By June
5th.
Within 12 days. And not only that, but the motion and a nice memorandum with it was attachment. It was thought out, it wasn't something that was happening, it was filed.
Okay. Now, after you filed on June 7th, then was there a motion to dismiss by the Attorney General based on the 30-day period?
The Attorney General has never asked to have this case dismissed on the 30-day period. have it dismissed on that basis. I think that the Attorney General, accustomed to the case law under these cases, has understood that in view of the uniqueness of this statute, the courts have been fairly liberal in allowing claimants to file outside the 30-day period where there are any kind of circumstances that warrant that kind of consideration.
Counsel, are you familiar with the percentage of employers who appeal an award to an employee?
I am not aware. You mean the percentage of how many?
Yeah, is it sort of automatic, or is it a rare thing, or what?
In my experience, Justice Sweeney, it's a rare thing.
So once the employee wins at the commission level,
right,
rarely does an employer then take it up.
I would say percentage-wise, the number of cases that get reported is very low.
Okay.
I don't have figures on that.
So it wouldn't really be necessary then for you to be alerted that once you won on the commission level, that an appeal is likely, so you better watch the time and so forth and watch the proceeding. That really doesn't come into play, does it?
It hasn't up until this case, but I think I'm very alerted now that I'm not going to let any time go by without calling claimants and finding out, did you get a notice of appeal?
No, but
I would say that ordinarily we would assume that there was not going to be another appeal filed after the final.
So you wouldn't have to worry about the 30 days, or anything, unless you got the notice
right
in the mail?
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Is there a statutory obligation to serve you also? Because they did serve your client, correct?
There is no statutory obligation to serve the client. It's a statutory obligation to serve the client.
Well, that's
done for the court to serve the client.
Was that done?
And that's it.
Was that done in the case?
The client served?
Yes.
I believe that it was. There is a return receipt signed by his wife on April 14th, although I noticed that the employer alleges in their brief that he was served by regular mail. It's sort of uncertain exactly what happened.
But your client never called you and said,
right,
as I was saying.
Right.
But there's no obligation on the AG or the employer to serve you, right?
That's correct.
So what they were required to do, they did either certified or ordinary.
Right. There is, of course, a requirement to serve parties on appeal before the commission. So then suddenly you get into court, and that whole requirement of notifying the attorney is just simply not there.
You were counsel of record
before the commission?
Before the commission.
Yes.
So the employer was aware of your presence in this case.
Right.
But did you ever advise your client to watch out that they might get something and promptly notify you if they did?
Is your primary effort before this court for us to find the statute unconstitutional? Is that your primary effort? What are you seeking? Your client was served.
Right.
No petition was filed as is required. So how are we to give you any relief?
Okay, let me try to respond this way, Justice. But I think that the statute was enacted the same year I graduated from law school, and I've been questioning its constitutionality ever since. It's a terrible statute. However, I find myself in the position of the constitutionality question taking second place to my client's rights, because...
What rights? What kind of rights? Constitutional rights?
Well, I believe that they are constitutional rights, yes. However, right now, I unfortunately have to put the constitutionality question in second place to the fact that this case was not properly... the judgment for the employer, and that's what this is. This is not a dismissal, as would be common if it were not the statute.
The lack of prosecution, you do it under
41. The lack of prosecution, and suddenly I'm accused of lack of, or the claimant is accused of lack of prosecution, when already on file is the motion for leave to plead pursuant to Zulovich. The motion to dismiss for lack of prosecution came after the case was being prosecuted. My primary concern right now, my some confusion as to the basis for that judgment, whether it was pursuant to Civil Rule 41, which is the failure to prosecute. And in that event, I would contend that we did not fail to prosecute. We were vigorously prosecuting it. Or whether it was dismissed pursuant to 4123.512, which says thou shalt file a petition within 30 days of the filing of the notice of appeal, which if you read that strictly, is going to tell you that even if the claimant doesn't get it until 45 days after the filing, he's still outside that 30-day period. So if that statute is going to be construed that strictly, and if the employer is going to take the position that this statute mandates
dismissal when something isn't filed within 30 days, then I think we're at a stalemate. There is no provision in 4123.512 to dismiss. It simply says file within 30 days. What, under Zulevic, you use that as your authority for your having filed this motion for leave to plead.
Right.
And under that, the holding in that case, you were required to show excusable neglect in
right.
failing to file properly. Now, it seems to me that's a difficulty here with the case as you presented, is that you never did, in terms of, in accordance with that Zulevic case, show excusable neglect for having filed the petition.
The court never ruled one way or the other on whether there was excusable. You know, they never
no, I'm saying
what I offered as excusable neglect.
What you offered that apparently in a supplement, not in your motion for leave to plead, right? Was it in a supplement?
It was in
a response to the motion
filed.
To
right.
In response
right.
to the motion to dismiss.
Right. And it was my position that the excusable neglect was, first of all, that the client's attorney was unaware the appeal had been filed and filed as soon as that notice came about, and secondly, that there was a constitutional challenge to this, which needed to be ruled on first before a complaint was filed.
And likewise, it's not maybe surprising that you didn't know you had to file a petition. You probably also didn't know that by statute you have to serve the attorney general when you're taking the position that a statute is unconstitutional. And so I assume here that wasn't done either.
I did serve the attorney general.
No, you served the attorney general in this case?
Sure.
To say about the unconstitutional
sure.
statute? Okay.
Yes.
I didn't think you had done that.
Yes.
The attorney general is representing the state in the comp case. I guess
right.
they are served. Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
Right. And they were served with that notice. There used to be further that I've been arguing that that statute is unconstitutional for 38 years, so they've seen it before. But yeah, they were serving it. But the concern is that irrespective of the constitutionality of the statute, was it fair in this particular case to give a narrow interpretation to this law when the claimant was there trying to prosecute this case? And 4123.95, the rule of construction, which is supposed to give the claimant some benefit for the obvious reason, I suppose that sometimes the statute is the least likely to understand the statute, and it's sort of twisted against him. I mean, fairness is the major issue in this. Can the employer, by filing a one-page notice of appeal and then sitting back, then come in and say, okay, we want judgment because there was no complaint filed by the claimant within 30 days. And
well, you have an argument on equal protection, and you cite Culver v. Young. And yet Culver v. Young points out that there is a very different situation between the ordinary plaintiff and the claimant, because in the ordinary plaintiff situation, the plaintiff's trying to get something and has something. In your case, the claimant has something. The claimant has a judgment. And as the Young case of the Cole case clearly points out, there's a great deal of disincentive on a claimant's part to do anything because that would upset the status quo. So by not filing at all, if it's a lump sum award, they don't get it back from the claimant, they get it back from the government. And if it is a periodic award, if it's longer they delay, the more money they get, they don't have to pay back. So what if we were to find, as you wish, that not filing a petition, which you did not do, and simply filing a motion to dismiss on the basis of constitutionality, continues to delay this case for a great deal of time while all those arguments are briefed and argued and the claimant continues to collect money. That's very different than a plaintiff's defendant situation where they have nothing and they're trying to get something. So how is your equal protection argument? I don't follow your equal protection argument.
Well, the equal protection argument goes to the procedure of it, Justice. I can't. In this particular case, he was back at work during the period that this was pending. And I think that is why, in the Hanna Coal Company case and most other cases, they say it has to be decided on an individual case basis. You can't just make a rule that's applicable for everything. I think that the equal protection comes in that the claimant is always required to go forward with the burden of proof, even when it's the employer that wants to get into court. You take one of these cases into court, the jury thinks that the claimant is the one that's appealing, because the claimant has to go first and sustain the burden of proof to establish what he has already won before the industrial court.
Well, then the whole idea of the case, of the appeal to the Commonplace Court being a de novo appeal, is you would challenge that also? Because that's what it is, as you know. How does the employer go forward if it's a de novo hearing and it's the claimant who essentially wants the Commonplace Court to do what the Industrial Commission did for the claimant?
I think the employer could go forward by calling their own witnesses. They could simply bring in their doctors, their witnesses, whatever they want to say did or didn't happen, and then let the claimant respond instead of always putting the burden on the claimant.
So you argue that this should be an appeal of error rather than to know, but that's what you would ideally like to see.
Not really, because I think an appeal with error is one where you're taking the record as it is and you're not bringing in anything new. If they want to bring in something new, that isn't precluded by finding that the employer is the one that should go forward. I don't think that limits it to an error appeal, although I know the Attorney General has raised that question. That's not my view of it, although it has been raised.
You have used your time.
Okay.
Thank you. Mr. Goldberg. You'll need to watch your time on the clock if you want to save time for Mr. Waterman.
May it please the Court, my name is Richard Goldberg. I'm with the firm of Scott State of the Wayne Office. I'm the lawyer, first, I'd like to emphasize, I think that the issues, at least when it comes to the first two propositions of law, I would disagree how it's been characterized by Thomas Keller. I don't think that what this court really should be looking at is a so-called fairness test. I think what the court needs to be looking at is, one, the standard under Zolkovich, and two, whether the trial court acted within its discretion to find that there was no showing of excusable neglect or other good cause. It's very clear under the Zolkovich case that a claimant does not file a petition within 30 minutes. The claimant can't just go ahead and file the petition. The claimant has to go ahead and seek leave of the court to file the petition and also make some show of excusable neglect or other than cause. Zolkovich goes on to say, obviously, in that instance, in order for a claimant to have to make a judgment whether there's been a showing of excusable neglect, a claimant has to have noticed that there's an issue of dismissal or judgment in favor of the employer, and that in addition to that, it has an opportunity to show excusable neglect or other good cause.
What about the fact that there was pending a motion to file a complaint and motion to find the statute unconstitutional, neither of which had been ruled on before the 30-day period had expired? Does that save the plaintiff?
No, it does not, Your Honor.
Judge Descher thought so, and that's why I'm asking.
No, in fact, if the claimant filed a petition within 30 days, then there's no issue.
Of course.
We submit that if a claimant files a motion to dismiss attacking the constitutionality, but doesn't do anything else, still makes no effort to file a petition, we submit that that's not good enough. That a claimant does not have the right to delay proceedings by coming up with a so-called constitutional months down the road, 9 months down the road, then I'll go ahead and file the petition. We submit that, that's not provided under 4123.502, and Zoltovic doesn't provide for that. Again, the appellant has talked about the issue of fairness, but let's look on the record what the appellant submitted to the trial. First, it's undisputed when it comes to the issue of notice that employer's motion for judgment was served on appellant's counsel. And again, the whole purpose of notice is to give the claimant an opportunity to show an excusable neglect or other good cause. The appellant in this case filed two responses, filed a memorandum in opposition and a supplemental memorandum. And as the trial court found and the Court of Appeals also found, there was simply no showing of excusable neglect or other good cause regarding a failure to file a petition. All the appellant did was if you look at first the memorandum in opposition, all the appellant did was state that, again, made this general constitutional attack. There was no explanation provided why the petition was not filed within 30 days. And then even in the supplemental memorandum, again, there's some talk about that there's no unconscionable delay or prejudice, as if, again, it doesn't matter if it's excusable neglect or other good cause. As long as we're talking 60, 90, or 120 days, and no one's sure, it's okay to do that. This court has made very clear that that's not good enough, that there, again, has to be a showing of excusable neglect or other good cause.
Do we have to rule for the appellant here? Do we need to conclude that the trial court abused its discretion?
I would say yes. I would think that you would have to find either that there was no notice given, there was no opportunity to show excusable neglect or good cause, or that under that standard, that the trial court was basically required to find that there was excusable neglect or good cause shown, and abused its discretion, finding that the grounds submitted was insufficient. And we submit that, again, none of those grounds exist here, and that, again, that the trial court acted within its discretion. As the Court of Appeals indicated, the trial court really only had one option in this case. If you take a look at such cases as Miller versus Swift, and even again the Zoltan case, some showing of excusable neglect or other good cause has to be made. It's not enough to just go ahead and file a petition. It's not enough to say, oh, come on, it's not. There's not much prejudice here, or to say that it's a drastic remedy to actually, in a case in which an employer has filed an appeal, to grant the motion for judgment. Well, this court has made it very clear that under 5112, that a claimant just can't go in and file a petition, and otherwise would make the 30-day limit meaningless. And again, when the appellant talks about the issue of fairness, we submit that the arguments that were made to the trial court were not as crystal clear as they are here today. If you take a look at that, it was somewhat vague exactly what the appellant was alleging, other than, again, admitting a constitutional attack or pointing out there was an unconscionable delay.
Mr. Goldberg, was the claimant served here?
Yes.
Does the record show the claimant was served?
Undisputed.
Right.
There was never an argument made by the appellant that service was not made. And both the Franklin County Court of Appeals also made that finding in its decision and it's supported by the record.
Is there something in the record then from counsel saying, my client didn't tell me anything under oath?
Well,
or even a statement?
If you take a look at the supplemental memorandum, mm-hmm. perhaps that inference can be drawn.
All right.
But it's not crystal clear.
But let's just say we draw that inference.
Okay.
Is that excusable neglect?
We submit on two different grounds that it's not. First, I think I cited the GTE case, 1976 case from this court, that makes it clear that a claimant's, or in this case, a claimant's neglect or ignorance of the law, that's not going to hold up, that a claimant is expected to know what the law is. And I guess the GTE case is almost the reverse, where if counsel neglected his or her duty, that then the claim is imputed to them. So it really goes both ways. It's also submitted that even if the law wasn't that way, look at what the appellant's argument in this case. As the Court of Appeals mentioned, there has never been a This is my reason why I didn't file a petition within 30 days. Here it is. We asked you to get a leave to be filed. I believe there's been a reference to a motion that was filed by the appellant. And if you look at it, it's about two sentences. All the motion says is motion for leave to file a motion to dismiss and or complaint. And then the appellant did go ahead and file a motion to dismiss. There was never ever a petition supplied along with that saying that we asked this court to grant us leave to file. Instead, the appellant went right back on track of where the appellant made his argument a constitutional attack. But we submit basically was defined what 4123.5 and 12 requires.
That's
a petition to file in 30 days.
When the postman came out to the appellant's what does that give to the appellant, Justin?
I believe first this would be showing the record what would have been provided by, this was done by the Franklin County Court of Appellate Police and Clerk of Court. I believe what's served on the appellant is a notice, first a notice of appeal, and I have to admit, I'm not sure at this point whether a 28 days summons would also be provided regarding the filing for petition. That I'm not sure whether that would be provided or not.
You don't even know what the appellant got.
I'm not sure if it presumes
to know the law. How much law are you presuming the appellant's supposed to know? That's what I want to know. What does the appellant get told?
Well, first of all, the appellant was represented here at the administrative level.
Well, sure. And so why not send a copy to the lawyer? Wouldn't that be
well,
fair?
That's kind of a dispute. Put it this way. That was actually a dispute that never really came to a head before the trial court because the appellant really never made any kind of personal argument about that, a crystal clear one. You'll see in the common police court record that there is a cover letter from our court, from our office, that was filed with the clerk of court that showed that a copy of that was sent to appellant's counsel. Now, whether appellant's counsel didn't get that, obviously I don't have personal knowledge of that. But that was really not an issue that was crystallized before the trial. And I don't believe that the appellant can, in a way, almost rectify the record by now making those arguments where those arguments really were not made clearly before the trial. The appellant had an opportunity to make that show, and really all that the appellant did was say, again, make this constitutional attack, say there was no unconscionable delay, and make these vague references to not being able to file within 30 days, but not really going into any detail why. So again, we submit that again, there's been proper notice, that there's been an opportunity. The constitutional argument, I'm going to be extremely brief because I want to give Assistant Attorney General Waterman an opportunity to address it. But again, when it comes to the third proposition, we submit there's been no showing of an equal protection violation or no showing of deprivation of due process. For again, brief protection, there would need to be a showing of similarly situated parties receiving dissimilar treatment. Under due process, we would submit that the rational basis test really applies here because there's been no showing of a suspect class or a fundamental right. And again, I think Mr. Waterman will address this as well. The appellant's argument on this issue where they're complaining that a claimant has to go forward in a 412-3512 appeal filed by an employer would basically require the employer, or if it is an estate fund, appeal in which the Attorney General's office would be involved to prove the negative. And in light of the de novo proceeding, we think that it makes sense, again, with the employer in a self-insured case and the bureau in a state fund case being a payor and the claimant being a payee, that there's a rational basis for that. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Goldberg. Mr. Waterman.
Counsel Jerry Waterman, representing the Appellee Administrator and Bureau of Workers' Compensation in this action. The administrator's involvement in this case is quite different than our co-appellee, Perry Township. The procedural issues the events and the controversy in the court below is a matter between Mr. Whitehurst and Perry Township. We did not take any kind of active role whatsoever in that. This is an employer's appeal to Common Pleas Court under 4123.512. The Industrial Commission had allowed the claim. Initially, my involvement was when I saw that a complaint wasn't filed, I wrote a courtesy letter to Ms. Cusack advising her that here is a copy of a notice of appeal. I had noted that she represented the claimant at the administrative level, obviously suggesting that action be taken in the case. What happened after that, the various motions, as I said, is a controversy different than our interests. Our interests, rather, involve the allegation that the statute is unconstitutional in its operation.
Before you go to the constitutionality, when you sent the letter dated May 26th, did you at that point think it was not yet too late to file the petition?
My tickler system would have been such that it would have probably been beyond the 30-day period. You know, we generally wait, and 99% of the time in an employer's appeal, a complaint comes in. So something triggered my writing.
So you would have been advising her of a vain act, to do a vain act?
Not necessarily. If she had the, if, for example, if she wasn't aware of the notice of appeal, and based upon the case law of this court and the courts of appeals, there is the opportunity to file a motion and show due cause.
Do we ever consider that the matter pending before the commission as an administrative matter is in the nature of a complaint?
Well,
because the rule of service under Rule 4 says that once an attorney enters their appearance, the attorney will be served with all papers as well from then on.
I believe administratively there is something, and you know, I will stand corrected if I'm incorrect, but if not, I believe in the new workers' compensation bill there is a provision regarding the service. I could be wrong about that.
I don't know about that. I'm just talking about the civil rules of procedure that say once an attorney enters an appearance, documents filed thereafter will be served on the attorney.
Well, as far as...
But it does say after the original complaint is filed. So I'm asking, is a proceeding before the commission where it starts de novo as administrative matter, could that be considered to be a complaint by the injured worker to receive compensation?
Well, it obviously would be a complaint in accordance with the civil rules because there isn't a court proceeding in existence yet. Since the Bureau of Industrial Commission never filed a notice of appeal to court, we wouldn't be in the position to actually serve anyone.
Okay, thank you.
But in this case, Mr. Whitehurst feels that the burden of proof and the burden of going forward should be on the employer and not the claimant. If I just may take a moment to let's run through that scenario, what happens. If it were, in fact, the employer's burden to go forward and file a complaint, you would have an employer filing the notice of appeal first, then filing a complaint. What would that complaint state? It would state, our employee did not sustain an injury in the course of employment. Obviously, the claimant would come back in an answer and say, oh, yes, I did. The case then goes forward to a trial. The employer calls its first witness. Let's say it's a personnel individual, or an individual from the personnel department, testifies the individual never sustained an injury. What happens then? The claimant surely isn't going to sit back and say, well, let's let it go to the jury and decide. The claimant still, the burden would shift to the claimant, and he or she would still have to come forward and present his case. Claimant alleges that there's expense involved and time involved in going forward first. This is going to have to occur. There is simply no way for the claimant, if he or she has to establish a right to participate, he simply cannot escape the circumstances of the need to get medical to support a condition, the need to present lay witnesses to support I saw him or her fall at work. The object here is for the claimant to establish the right to participate. It's a de novo proceeding. The jury is not even supposed to know that anything occurred during an administrative level. There has been absolutely no property right being taken away from the claimant. Yes, it is an allowed claim, And this is just simply the last stage of an appeal process. And it has been provided that that last stage starts anew. It is a de novo proceeding. The burden of proof is upon the party asserting the affirmative. The claimant is here. I want the right to participate. He or she has that burden of proof. He must go forward.
You need to sum up, Mr. Waterman.
We thank you very much. We believe that this statute and its operation is entirely practical, logical, and reasonable, and also it is constitutional. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Waterman. Ms. Kusak, you've used your time, but take 30 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor. One thing that I want to make emphatically clear that I find a matter of great concern, this situation is not done to delay. And I think enough of you on this court know that I don't practice law that way. I resent the inference that it was done for that reason. 4123.512 requires the claimant to file a complaint alleging jurisdiction. If jurisdiction is to be challenged, it must be challenged separate and apart from the complaint. It must be challenged under Civil Rule 12. That's what we did in this case. That is the reason that there was no complaint attached to the motion for leave to plead. There is no requirement that a complaint be filed with a motion for leave to plead. And I invite your attention to the supplemental memorandum in which I clearly stated that I did not have notice of that appeal, and the Civil Rule 11, which says that when a lawyer signs a pleading in the court, it had better be true that his or her signature to that pleading constitutes an allegation that what's in it is true. And I ask you to consider that this is the most unfair to the claimant, and to seriously consider the dissent in the Court of Appeals, and I ask that you adopt that dissent in this particular case.
Thank you. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.